Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Shake Anything podcast. I'm Doug Williams. No, I'm not. I'm Andy Martino. Doug, I fooled you for a second, but Doug is gallivanting around the globe. Mm-hmm. He is probably not even thinking about baseball right now. So I'm here with Nelson Figueroa, my good friend, who's able to break things down probably better than either of us who normally sit at this table for the podcast. So, Nelson, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Normally, you're filling in for me when I'm gallivanting, but today you're filling in for Doug. So, we want to start with the Mets offense, which, if you may or may not have noticed over the weekend, has not been particularly effective lately. I find in covering teams and in trying to ask managers, hitting coaches, hitters, what's wrong with your slumping offense, it's probably the hardest question to report on, write about, or answer, because it's pretty mysterious, right? It's just like, I don't know, man. We're all talented, and we're in this huge group slump. Do you see anything with the Mets offense right now, Nelson, that tells you, big picture, that they've got something to worry about? The first couple weeks were a mirage, and this is really bad? Or do you just see one of those things that teams fall into?
At this point, this is my fifth year of being on SNY and seeing it happen almost every year, right?
Yeah, it's weird. I thought this year it wasn't going to happen.
And you didn't think it was going to happen because you had enough guys who had veteran qualities, who understood the whole team first initiative, hit the ball the other way, put the ball in play, doing the little things. To me, it wasn't that it was a mirage, because we see they have the ability to do it. I think one of the things is that teams make adjustments. And you have to be able to adjust back. What we're seeing a lot of is a lot of off-speed pitches, a lot of breaking balls. The slower the breaking ball, the better, because I think the Mets were really getting off on fastballs and fastball counts, hitting the ball solid on those fastballs, and not worrying about the breaking ball and swinging at the breaking ball.
So you have a lot of veteran hitters on that team. Even a guy like Nimmo, who's been not a veteran by any means, but has been in the league long enough for there to be video on him and word about him. Conforto's been in the league a lot of years. Cano, Wilson, Ramos, guys. The book on them is already known, I would assume. So how is it that teams are feeding them too many fastballs in 2019 and then adjusting after 3 or 4 weeks of 2019? How does that work where it's like a reset in the beginning of the season?
Because a lot of pitching coach philosophies are you want to get beat with your best stuff, and your fastball, your command of your fastball predicates anything else. If you don't have command with your fastball, then you wind up having to throw fastballs and fastball counts because you're falling behind. Now, we've seen a ton of teams, and a guy like Zach Davies is a great example from yesterday. It was nonstop off speed, and then all of a sudden the fastball was a click quicker, and you could see these guys lunging and looking out of sorts, and this guy's throwing 78 miles an hour, and you're sitting here going, how are they not squaring him up? The plan and the attack from every single Milwaukee Brewer pitcher seemed to be, go with the slow stuff, unless your name was Hader,
right?
Which unbelievable.
He has a different strategy.
Unbelievable.
Velocity-wise.
And you heard, what was it, Conforto say, I swung a foot over where the ball was supposed to be?
Hader's just contact. A freak, what he's doing right now.
Right, exactly. So he doesn't change, he won't deviate from his plan, but when you see these other guys and you see them going to their secondary and tertiary pitches, it's impressive because it's almost like they're working through it because they know they still have the good fastball to go to the second, third time through the lineup, and now you have guys guessing. And it's difficult to say because it's team-wide, and I've seen it before where teams would be against me and they would, you know, sit the first time and let me get myself into trouble because I would kind of throw breaking balls around the zone and let him come back to the middle of the plate with his fastball, and that's the second time around they would get aggressive. But it doesn't seem like the Mets have that in them. Like, I don't see the aggressiveness, you know, looking for the fastball. Then they're waiting. They're trying to be patient. So it's like all the approaches all rolled into one, and you can't have that.
So is that how it happens, or a part of how it happens when we see a group slump, when they're all now trying to do too much at the same time and they're not just sitting back and relaxing and making those kinds of adjustments? One guy after another can sort of do that as they all try to fix this on their own?
Yeah, you're seeing a lot more at bats ending with a guy looking like he just missed a pitch and popping the ball up rather than hitting that little line drive. And it's easier said than done. Don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here saying, oh, just put the ball in play. Yeah, it sounds great. But when it's, you know, guys getting you out with pitcher's pitches most of the time. And when you do miss the mistakes over the middle, I think Conforto came up in that pinch hit, yesterday as well, where it was a big situation. And he got a pitch to just hammer, and he missed it. And you could just see, like, the body language was like, oh, that was the one. And now he was in protect mode to try and hit the ball the other way, which was the game plan, but he couldn't do much with it in that situation.
You think it's a fair knock on a guy like Conforto to say, like, hey, you're Michael Conforto. You're the guy. Come up big in the big moment. That's an easy thing to, as a fan, I'm sure, to want. And for us as commentators to say, this is where Michael Conforto needs to be their Aaron Judge. This is where Michael Conforto needs to step up. Is that realistic in baseball? He got a pitch to hit. He just missed it. That happens. Are we only noticing that and heavily criticizing something like that because of what's going on? Or do you think it's fair to say a guy like Michael Conforto has to put the Mets on his back right now?
Listen, for 20 at-bats, he's allowed to falter. Over the course of a season, he's going to succeed in those situations more times than not. That's what you want from your superstars. That's what makes you a superstar and all-star type player. Conforto is still that type hitter, even when he's gone through this slump. It's the other guys around where you have four guys. When we talked about it before we came on, it was like a 2-for-76 that they were mired in. That can't happen. That there just has to. And then you see guys like Lagares trying to bunt his way on and popping the ball up. And then you're just compounding the problem, right?
Right.
Instead of kind of just keep it as simple as possible. Jeff McNeil type at-bats. And even McNeil has struggled. And we haven't seen that prolonged slump. But McNeil has gotten, you know, four hit nights, you know, one after another, and then when he goes 0-for-3, you're like, oh, what's going on? So I think you have to kind of look at it from series to series, and sometimes you have to tip your cap. The Brewers seem to have had their number and pitched them almost perfectly. The problem is that the rest of the league learns from that game plan.
I think we're fairly confident to say that McNeil's going to be a solid hitter. That a guy like Pete Alonso is going to be a solid hitter. Like you said, Conforto is somebody who's going to succeed. Maybe not as much as he fails because it's baseball, but succeed a fair amount of the time over the course of the whole season. The one area when I look at this offense, and I've been very bullish on this offense. I have thought that they're sustainable until recently. The one thing that gives me real concern is that middle of the order where you have Wilson Ramos and Robinson Cano, who are supposed to be like, oh, wow, you got Cano and Ramos in the middle of the order. You got two thumpers right there, which the Mets haven't necessarily had two of those guys in a long time. And both of them are suddenly looking a little, at their age, you start to worry a little when they have a bad month, especially Ramos, who's hitting the ball on the ground way more than he ever has, slugging like less than 400 right now, and just doesn't look like the hitter. So if you're facing Wilson Ramos right now, are you thinking, oh, he just got old. This is the year where it's happening. Or are you just thinking he's still very dangerous?
Well, you always kind of think he's dangerous, but when you start looking at the numbers over a long period of time, especially when you start looking at 20 at bats, you know, at a time, and you say, okay, what's going on with this guy? And you see maybe there's patterns that he likes to go to a first pitch fastball he should never see.
Right.
Honestly, you let him get ahead with the breaking ball, and then all of a sudden they start to get him to chase the fastball. When you see Wilson Ramos chasing pitches out of the zone and looking uncomfortable with those swings, that's when you know you have him, and you want to keep him in that momentum, keep his wheels kind of spinning and guessing. He's not a good guess hitter. He's a reactionary hitter where if the pitch is on the outside part of the plate, inside part of the plate, he has a game plan of going the other way. But I don't think anyone could have foreseen him being just a slap hitter, hitting.
What is that?
A 300 slap hitter. That's not what they were hoping for. That's not what I still don't think that's what they're going to get. I think as the summer heats up and hopefully he gets a little bit more rest so that there's a little bit more whip in that swing, he's still going to be a dangerous hitter. I don't see guys just because they're over 30, it's over for them. I think there were way too many ball players who played into the late 30s.
You were one of them.
Well, exactly. while watching all these hitters make adjustments as they got older to whether it's being a good guess hitter and taking that one swing with everything you got, I don't like seeing the, okay, just putting the ball in play for the sake of putting the ball in play, because that's not what a successful team does.
What do you think accounts for, maybe you just answered it, but for Ramos hitting the ball on the ground so much all of a sudden when he's this massive human being? He's been this great power hitter. I mean, just a beast for his entire career. An all-star last year. He's just getting out of himself a little bit.
Yeah, he's just reaching. I mean,
you don't see it as bat speed or age?
No, it's not. It's not bat speed to me. It's really almost like game plan is set in motion for him that I'm going the other way. I haven't seen him pull a ball. I can't remember the last time I saw him pull a ball with any authority. I really don't. And so,
and that's who he is.
It is who he is, but I still think that he's got to be able to do it just to change the pitcher's mentality. Even if it's one swing for all the marbles, for Todd Frazier's pull it foul in a 3-1 count. Just let it eat one time. And that'll maybe get you going a little bit, because right now he seems to be so passive, so mechanical. And for a hitter or a pitcher, when you're mechanical at the plate or you're mechanical on the mound, that's a detriment. You want to be as fluid, mm-hmm. as smooth and easy. You want that muscle memory to take over. And right now you're seeing him extending his strike zone more than ever. He's got a lot of swing and miss because he's chasing a lot of pitches. And that's not who Wilson Ramos is. This is a guy who can take a walk. He doesn't mm-hmm. strike out. I think he's only struck out over 100 times once in his career. So he's not that strikeout machine that we're seeing right now.
And he's, like you said, he's much less selective right now than yep. he usually is. And that contributes, but more strikeouts, it probably contributes to rolling over those balls and getting those ground outs all the time. Yeah. With Cano, are you surprised to see, or as surprised as I am, or as probably most people are, to see him hitting, what, he hit 600 in spring training? It was like, oh, the Mets got Robinson Cano. This dude is still Robinson Cano. And he comes out, and I know he's been a little bit better lately. He's up to 260-something, mm-hmm. but he hasn't been, just like we talked about with Ramos, he hasn't been that dynamic guy in the middle of the order. What do you see in there?
Yeah, with him, I think it's more of he wants to be that everyday player. And in mm-hmm. this day and age, we know. I mean, go 10 games at a time and then give the guy a break, just to, even if it's a mental break.
He's never done that. So you think he's at the point of his career where he has to
honestly,
step back a
honestly,
little.
I think he has to step back a little bit. I know he wants to be the guy, and you can still be the guy late in the game and come up, you know, in the eighth inning in a pinch mm-hmm. hit role. But I do think that you have to start looking at him the same thing I used to say about Cabrera and Bruce and all those guys, where it was like, okay, if this is the new age of a full-time player should play 130 of his best games, mm-hmm. then you have to be able to go to them and say, you're getting the day off no matter what. Mm-hmm. And what happens with that normally is, Cano will get the three-hit game right before it, and he doesn't want to sit, and he'll say, I don't want to sit. They put him back in the lineup, and then it starts off the bad streak. And then he goes for 0-3, and he says, no, I want to go again because I just went 0-3, and now you're sitting there fighting with the player who, yes, this guy plays an average of 156 games a year,
yeah.
at least. And so he wants to still be that guy. But in this day and age, it is not beneficial to be pushed, especially early, because I don't want this guy to get mired in a slump. I don't want Cano to get mired in a slump. I don't want him to feel
right,
like
Robinson
he has
Cano of all the important people.
I don't yeah. want him to feel, again, he's in the three hole or even mm-hmm. you know a four hole, wherever you want to put him in the middle of that lineup. His bat has to play up at all times. And the best part about him isn't the home run power. It's the line to line.
Absolutely.
Unpredictability of, hey, he could put this swing on it. He could put that swing on it. But him putting the ball in play with hard contact. When you start seeing that hard contact dip down, and they have the metrics to see it.
They
so
sure
if
do.
You start seeing that dip down, you say, hey, you know what? Take a day, take 2 days off, because you have a guy like McNeil mm-hmm. that can play second base. You have other options to move around, and that's supposed to be where the depth comes in. The depth that shouldn't come in only when there's an injury. The depth is supposed to keep everybody fresher, supposed to keep the bench guys a little bit fresher as well, because they're now in a routine of, hey, I'm going to play, you know, if it's six games, I'm going to play in two of them mm-hmm. and maybe pinch hit in one of them, but at least they're getting the reps that they need to do to stay as solid as they can. And so for Cano, a little bit less, I think, will end up being a lot more.
Well, it's a concrete solution. And there you have it, folks. Nelson Figueroa says it's time for Robinson Cano to stop playing 156 games a year if he wants to preserve that career from age 36 to where 41, I guess. The Mets have him for another 5 years.
Close
so you're right.
That, yeah.
Someone you have to preserve. Moving on to the pitching, I want to pick your brain about two guys that you and I have certainly talked about a lot, but now that we have the chance to do a real deep dive into Syndergaard and Wheeler, who I would argue are the two most important or at least pivotal players on the Mets roster. You're assuming that DeGrom, and I know this has been complicated this year so far too with DeGrom, but let's just assume that DeGrom's the ace. Mm-hmm. And when things sort out, you can count on him for being the ace. Let's just assume that the offense is pretty good. It's going to go up and down. So if you have Syndergaard and Wheeler as a top shelf 2-3, then to me you have a championship caliber team that no one wants to face in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. If Syndergaard and Wheeler are not pitching well, then your team really has its work cut out for it, the way that the Mets are designed. So let's look at the two of them. So with Syndergaard, true or false, his complete game shutout that he pitched last week fixed every concern you've ever had about him, and he's going to go on and be an all-star Cy Young for the rest of the year, and everything's fine. True or false?
False.
Okay.
Why? Because as I've been saying with Noah Syndergaard, and it's no knock on his ability, mm-hmm. I need to see more. Not
consistency
one game.
And health.
Yes, not one game. It's three games in a row of this type, and it doesn't have to be complete game. It doesn't have to be 10 strikeout. It has to be what I was more impressed with anything was he kind of went against the grain. He went with feel.
Yes.
He went with Fia. What felt better as a breaking ball that day? His curveball. Threw the most curveballs he's ever thrown in a game, practically. The fewest sliders he's thrown since he's learned how to throw a slider. And that shows you where he's not that brute, throwing, trying to throw through a wall all the time. And what we kept saying about him is challenging hitters to the same place in the zone. What was funny was he threw two pitches on the inside part of the plate, I think it was, to any righty the whole game. And yes, it was a team who struggled, who's been struggling offensively, but still, his ability to go out there and continue to be successful by using that curveball and changeup combination. And then the fastball had a little bit more zip on it. The strikeouts came later on in the game, which I always love because he's a kind of the pitcher that will start out with a bang. He'll strike out the side in the first. It may take him 28 pitches to do so. And then you're sitting there going, was it worth it? To me, it's never worth it that first time through the lineup.
I think in the, I'm speaking off the top of my head here, but I think in that shutout, he got two strikeouts in the first inning with breaking balls.
Yep.
One a curveball, one a slider, if I remember correctly. And I'm glad you mentioned the off-speed pitches, because this, to me, tell me if you agree or disagree, but look, we all know that Mickey Callaway struggled on numerous fronts since he's been here in a lot of ways, and he's trying to learn how to be a better manager. But one thing that he really seems to be bringing a value is this thing he's drilling into certain pitchers' heads about velocity differential, right? He's telling, and DeGrom is a case too, where he's telling DeGrom, slow down that slider, throw your changeup more. I mean, with Syndergaard, it seems like he's been trying to get Syndergaard to throw that curveball more for a long time. He's saying, Noah, he throw 90 to 99, and the hitters can gear up for that velocity and just have to look at location. You know that, so in his shutout, Syndergaard's throwing what, 81, 82 to 99 probably?
Yep.
Dropping in that hammer in the first inning. So that's a pretty dramatic transformation of how he pitched prior to that game, is it not?
It is, and that's what you're where I'm saying you need to see more. I want to see him be able
to do it again.
And now add in the slider a little bit more. And then be able to use the changeup a little bit more. And what Syndergaard really did well for a long time, when, and at least when he was healthy, he pitched backwards with power stuff. That's unheard of because most guys are pedal to the metal. Here's my fastball. Here's my slider. Hit it if you can.
Explain to our listeners what pitch backwards means.
Pitch backward means starting out the at-bat with a first pitch curveball, because if they're geared up for that first pitch fastball, now even if they foul it off, that's one pitch wasted, right? You're ahead on
a
strike.
And the rest of the time they're confused as far as what's coming and what
sequence. Exactly. Now what you're looking at a lot with Syndergaard is when he has these games that leave you puzzled is two strike counts that he loses. When you're losing a two strike count with that kind of stuff, it infuriates you as a pitcher, because now you're going to try even harder with two strikes and you're going to make less and less of those key pitches.
And in those situations where he's failing with two strikes, it's a lot of four-seam fastballs,
right? It's a lot of four-seam fastballs.
So it comes down straight, they foul it off, pitch count goes up. So now he's not pitching backwards necessarily, or it wasn't in this game, but he's dropping that hook as a strikeout pitch.
Dropping that hook as a strikeout pitch, using his changeup even as a strikeout pitch out of the zone. And one thing with him is that we know you can kind of narrow in on a certain section of the plate with two strikes. And what you're seeing is guys fouling off that nasty slider or taking that slider when they see it just on the outside, because it does move. It's not like it sits straight. Like a lot of the most successful sliders nowadays are the ones that look like, okay, it's a slider, they recognize it, but it kind of drops down rather than moves to the side. Syndergaard's slider moves sideways, and so as soon as they read slider, they let it go because it's going to be nasty, 95 and off the plate. It doesn't stay and catch enough plate. They see it out of his hand because his release point is right above his head.
Do you consider that tipping?
Yes, I do. And that's one of the things he talks about in his mechanics. A flaw in his mechanics is he's showing the pitch right up above him every single time, and they're kind of seeing, and they can say, out of the hand, it's a ball or a strike.
Right.
At 100 miles an hour, they can still see almost, they read it a lot sooner. Whereas with Jacob DeGrom riding underneath the baseball, there's a moment where you kind of lose sight of what pitch is coming and where is it coming and which way is it going to go. Because he can go 89 to the right with a slider, 89 to the left with a changeup. He can go 85 down with a curveball. So all those planes that he can touch, that's the art of pitching. And so when Noah was out there, the first couple of outings was, I'm going to pitch up in the zone. But it wasn't even like, it wasn't by design. He was just late on his command, and we saw the, oh, look, he's pitching up in the zone, and you could see the scouter points, and yet you never saw the catcher one time put his glove up.
Right, he was missing the target.
He's just missing the target.
What's he in that? But those are still four seams,
right? Those are four seams.
So because one of the knocks on Syndergaard from some people, and I don't think I know your opinion on this, is that He needs to let go of the strikeout thing. He needs to be a sinker ball guy. I don't care if he can throw 99 or 100. Keep that pitch count down. Get more ground balls. Pitch to contact. Do you subscribe to that's the future of Noah Syndergaard, and if he's effective?
No.
You want him to keep striking guys out?
I do, because if he can do it in four pitches, whether, again, it's a slam dunk or a layup, it's 2 points, right? So if he can get an out within four pitches, I just can't have him throwing 24-pitch innings
right. Every
other inning. One inning come in and have a 7-pitch, and then all of a sudden go back out there and it's a 30-pitch inning. It can't take 30 pitches with that kind of stuff. And basically, it's not the machismo, hey, here's my fastball and hit it. It's more of, okay, I'm going to change gears right here. Mm-hmm. And the pitching backwards thing is something that he's so good at. And he used to fight with Travis all the time, because Travis was kind of, you know, hey, fastball, let's go with your best fastball. Let's go with your best slider. Let's just keep pounding with that. Where he was like, 3-1, I'm throwing a changeup.
So Noah himself has got the wherewithal to do that, because he gets to knock on him, this kid's got a big arm, but he doesn't know how to pitch. You don't think that's totally fair?
No, it really isn't fair. And it's frustrating, because when you see him have his best games or his best outings is when he's able to do the pitching backwards, where he's not shaking off to get to it. Because you get out of rhythm, you get out of timing, and then you're having to think for two. And that's not easy on the mound. And I've been saying this the whole year, is that Syndergaard seems to be pitching as if he's pitching a bullpen. And he's not reading the hitters and the hitter's swings and what
that's
the hitters are doing.
Point.
He's going out there with, I'm going to do this no matter what the hitter is doing. And you can't succeed that way. There's a major league hitter who has a plan, and they're trying to make sure that you are better than them at executing that plan. So I have to read hitters. My whole career was, I read the hitter's swing.
Right.
Radar gun, turn it off, throw it out. That, to me, ruined baseball for me. Because guys are looking at the radar gun and they're like, oh, he's only throwing this. Meanwhile, my mechanics, it was a lot of visual velocity. So the hitter would see the ball with late movement and they would be like, okay, this guy's throwing 92, 93, 94. Meanwhile, it's 88, but I'm controlling that 88 with movement on both sides of the plate.
And you're knowing how to take a little bit off.
Take a little bit off.
The swing.
Yep, go a little bit up in the zone, a little bit higher in the zone, read that swing, read the take on the breaking ball on the plate. Bouncing breaking balls is not a bad thing. Dan Worthen taught me that. Mm-hmm. And once he took me to the next level of, listen, we're going to mess up this dozen baseballs in practice, but you're not going to leave a two-strike curveball over the plate or a two-strike slider over the plate. The idea is to make it look like a strike and not be a strike. Mm. So bounce them. It's not a bad thing to scuff up the baseball. They'll give you a new one. He kept saying that. And just
funny
learn
guy,
how to expand. Word. Learn how to expand the zone. And I think what we're seeing is that he's so hell-bent on commanding the strike zone, and it makes it easier for a hitter, especially when they can eliminate the inside part of the plate, now to hang over that plate and at least foul off and make him throw 24 to 30 pitches.
How'd you feel about Zach Wheeler's start in Milwaukee, where he seemed to have better stuff than the previous time out? It was the one bad inning thing for Wheeler.
Yep.
That's been the thing that's gotten him. Mm-hmm. A couple of starts ago, he was absolutely brilliant.
Oh,
and we just see, like, oh my God, does this guy have the best stuff on the staff? Probably when he's on. I mean, you could make that argument still.
Absolutely.
The split finger, the slider, the curveball, that fastball that seems to have the late life. So where is he right now in terms of how optimistic you're going to be over the next handful of starts? Because by the way, as we record this, they got two starters going, one on the injured list, one going there. Uh-huh. They've got DeGrom, who's still trying to figure himself out. So Zach Wheeler becomes,
yes.
I understand that DeGrom came back in a major way, but it's only one start.
Right.
Where's Wheeler?
Where's Wheeler? Wheeler is, he's in a good spot, as someone would
I've
say.
I've heard that one before.
He's in a good spot, and I'll tell you why. Because I think Zach Wheeler, in the beginning of the season, again, was kind of going through the motions a little bit. I've said this before about, you know, spring training, and he didn't end spring training very well. And he kind of just thought he could go through the motions and, you know, attack the hitters maybe the second or third time through the lineup, and hitters were getting to him early. And then you saw him go into a tailspin, and he reverted back to old Zach Wheeler, where I'm going to throw this ball through a wall, walk seven. You're like, okay, dude, this isn't who you are.
Right.
And that's one of the things I credited him when I spoke to him in spring training, was becoming a pitcher and having that feel and reading hitter swings and going, okay, he was on that slider on the outside part of the plate, but now I can make this changeup go inside on him. Now, can he cover the inside part on that changeup at the same speed and the slider? If he can do that, then he's never going to touch this 98-mile-an-hour fastball that's up in the zone. So he had the ability to do all those things in a nutshell. We saw that when he put it all together in that one start with the double-digit strikeouts. This last start, yes, one bad inning. But I think what you're looking for is, how does he recover from that? And what happens normally after you have that awesome game of a lifetime, that next one is a little bit
could
of
be
a letdown.
Letdown.
Could be a letdown. And if that's the letdown, I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that bad of an outing. It could have been better if it wasn't for the one inning. But you learn that can't take an at-bat off, can't take a pitch off, because all it takes is one mistake to turn that game around, where that focus has to be laser-like for 18 minutes. Mm-hmm. 18 minutes of a ball game is a pitcher focusing on, yes, that's the pitch I want to make, and executing that pitch.
You're saying 18 minutes is how long you're out there?
18 minutes is as long as you're out there.
I didn't know that. I mean, it makes sense, but that's a fascinating stat.
You chop it up at...
Feels like a whole night, and it is in a way, but 18 minutes.
18 minutes. Huh. It's like when you're watching a football game, and you actually count down how much time is actually gameplay and actually executed snaps, and for a quarterback even, most of them, you know, handoffs and everything else. And when it comes down to how many throws he actually makes and how much time he's in the pocket getting rid of it, what is it, 2 seconds and they get rid of the ball? Count that as 2 seconds. He had to focus and make a play and make a read.
That's a great point.
So I need that from my pitchers, is focusing on that kind of level, that, dude, give me everything you got. Every single pitch of every inning that you're out there, because that's all that matters. Otherwise, you'll be sitting in the film room for hours afterwards going, what did I do wrong?
It's funny, in your comment on Wheeler going back to his old self and just trying to throw the ball through the wall and forgetting about being a pitcher, to me, just as a non-pitcher, as a non-athlete, as someone who I'd never pitched at any level, I was a catcher in Little League, and then I became a writer because I knew what my skill set was.
There you go.
But I it's amazing to me the intensity of competition, how intense it must be, where you can know, Zach Wheeler knows, he talked about it, he had a verbal conversation about it. He was out on the mound a couple turns earlier, and it was going great, and he didn't have, and then you get out there, and you just, I don't know if you get a little nervous or a little tense, and you go back to those bad habits, how easy that is. It's fascinating. You can know better, and you can still do the wrong thing.
And especially with Zach Wheeler, where you see how his mechanics, how fluid he is, right? And he takes a little bit longer, and all that matters is if he takes a little bit too long, and then he starts thinking about his mechanics, he's lost.
Yeah, you can see him start to think. His pace, boy, when he that's a great point. And when he is feeling good, he works quick.
Yes.
And when he's feeling not good, it is he's dice chaos. There.
Yeah.
It's like the difference.
And that's the thing, is that you want to stay in that rhythm.
Yeah.
And so what you don't want to change is the rhythm of your mechanics, the tempo of your mechanics. It's all about the tempo. If you can keep the tempo of your mechanics the same every time, and you can work quickly and be on the same page with your catcher and not have to worry about, does he know what he's calling out there? I know what we said on paper before the game, and I'm not going to lie, there were a few times that it was a 45-minute pitching game plan, and you're like almost falling asleep because you're talking about the 12th hitter in a row. That
you guys are athletes, you're not built for meetings.
And it's just it's almost too much information, right?
Yeah.
So what do you want to do? What are you successful at doing? Hey, I can use my fastball in all four quadrants, and that's four pitches in itself. So don't overthink
the
simplicity.
Go out there and feel it.
Don't overthink the simplicity. Go out there, find that fastball, find your best breaking ball, and it could change inning by inning, at bat by at bat, batter by batter, even if you see the swing that they give you on one breaking pitch, or if they lay off that nasty slider. Now that sets them up for the curveball, because it's a slower pitch with a different spin. You have to be able to throw pitches off of other pitches, and that's, to me, is the art of pitching, is slowing them down, speeding them up, making them believe they see what they see, and that's what a hitter swings at. They swing at what they think they see. And if you can change that, where it's 3/4 of the way to the plate and it can do something different, you're always going to be at the advantage as long as you're not predictable.
Quick answer on Wheeler before we get to our last topic of the rotation. How close is he to becoming that guy you just described? And his evolution as a pitcher, is he real close?
He's real close. He's real close, and I think the mindset that he has of just focusing on task at hand and each and every time, and then you get off the mound, take your stroll, do whatever you gotta do. But once you get on that mound and it's play ball time and the batter steps in there, he is a guy with dominant stuff. We're talking about, and he has now pushed it to another level where he's averaging 98 to 100. On his fastball. We've seen him at 101.
With life
on it.
Not that Syndergaard straight fastball.
No, and he's a little bit, again, like DeGrom, where he gets a little bit under the ball and the ball rides. So that's been a real key. No matter how hard you throw, pitching up in the strike zone is done more with deception than it is with actual velocity. So that, to me, is where he is a lot closer than Syndergaard is. Like, I love what I saw out of Syndergaard because he threw a lot of curveballs. Seeing him do that again, and once you've gone to that point of going complete game, it's the next start to afterwards where you might feel a little sorer than normal. You might feel a little, you know, like you didn't throw enough sliders, so you're going to try and throw more sliders. So it might be a growing pain to see, but I need to see him not have a 25 to 30 pitch first inning. Wheeler is close to being that guy that we saw in the second half every time.
Okay, put all that great analysis together. Give me one word answer on this one, and that word is going to be name, and it's either going to be Wheeler or Syndergaard. Who do you want? Who do you predict a better future for over the next, say, 3 to 5 years? One word, Wheeler or Syndergaard? Who's going to have the next 3 to 5 years of dominance over the other?
I think Wheeler is.
There you go.
I think Wheeler is.
Rotation depth, the last thing I want to get into today. I share a little reporting, which isn't that exciting, because it's that Dallas Keuchel is still available, according to my sources. He's still a free agent, doesn't pitch in the major leagues, which is continually sort of shocking, even though he's a pitcher in decline. I've been saying this. The Mets are kind of been on him. I'm just not catching this vibe like they're going to be the team that ultimately ends up with him. That could change. That could be something that the GM sells to ownership is like, hey, this is the piece we need. But Brody has spent a lot already, and as a GM, made a lot of acquisitions, and I'm just not sure that that's the fit. I think that if Keuchel goes up to the draft, which some baseball people think he will, then the Yankees will be in on him, and Mets fans can be miserable about that. But Keuchel aside, do you think that this team has the starting pitching depth that, say, starters 6 through 9 to withstand the injuries, the attrition we're seeing it right now with Vargas and Mats with relatively short-term injuries, they hope. Mm-hmm. But now they traded for a guy, Wilmer Font, journeyman who can make a spot start. You got Oswalt. You got Hector Santiago in AAA. Mm-hmm. How you feeling about all that?
I'm feeling like any other year and any other team, then you would be okay with that. Mm-hmm. And I think the 5-1 start, which wasn't an 11-1 start, and the offense being as good as it was early on, you want more and feel like you need more. Mm-hmm. I also say it's a marathon, not a sprint. And if you panic too soon, and what it does is it creates, now you get an extra starter, and now you have doubt as far as who is now in your rotation, because you have six starters when five.
Which is why they didn't sign Gio Gonzalez.
Exactly, and they didn't feel like that was a big enough upgrade. Remember, Keuchel's still out there for reasons, plus the draft pick. And then June, it'll be a lot sexier option for a lot of teams. And I think enough teams are treading water that they're going to see if they can do it for another month and see where they're at in June and check exactly how big the need is. Because you have to remember, he's not just going to walk into the stadium and be ready to pitch.
No, 4 to 6 weeks, right?
Exactly. So you're looking at him as being really, if you sign him in June, he's basically a trade deadline.
That's a good way to put it. And now, so now a team like the Yankees that wasn't interested in the offseason is saying, okay, he is now on the list of Bumgarner, Stroman, Keuchel, like in terms of trade deadline type guys you can get. And that's a good point. That's where Keuchel is. Maybe the Mets will be in a position to need that one piece too. But let's not assume anything with the Mets. Yeah. They're having a tough time right now. And I had one general manager check with me as a reporter who covers the Mets if Syndergaard and Wheeler will be available next in July for them to acquire. So let's just see. I said that doesn't seem to be where the Mets' heads are at right now. But just like it's no sure thing that the Mets are going to be one pitcher away.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what you do is you kind of go month by month. And we saw the meltdown happen in June last year. I don't believe the meltdown is happening in May to that same degree. Again, a change of scenery. Lovely San Diego can be a nice spot for them to break out in bunches. I think what you hope for is when they get back home and the weather is warming up, it's no longer throwing ice cubes around like we've heard. It's more getting back to baseball weather and guys just really worrying about playing good fundamental baseball. The errors have accumulated. I mean, you're seeing a guy like Broxton, yesterday? The line drive that goes over his head.
Who's there basically for his defense.
He's there for his defense.
There for how long is another question.
Exactly. But. Well, yeah, Rosario, who, you know, seems to go through these fits.
That is a weird one, by the way. Ahmed Rosario's got good hands.
Yes.
What the hell is going on?
And it's almost he takes it for granted that how good his hands are. And I'm going to tell you this. The grass is cut differently at the major league level than it is in the minor league level. Believe it or not, and it's because of design and everything else that they do. And the balls will take different hops. Even though it's nice and clean once it hits the dirt, if you're lackadaisical at any moment and mm-hmm. take your eye off that ball. That's all it takes for that same spin rate we talk about for breaking balls and sliders. That ball takes a little bit more spin on that second hop and then comes off the dirt. It's like a catcher trying to block that breaking ball that stays down. Right? What do you want to see the catcher do? Drop to a knee. We right. saw that first ground ball that got hit to him yesterday. He almost dropped to a knee to make sure that ball wasn't getting by him.
Right.
And he was going to corral it. I don't like him being that mechanical, but hey,
he's in a mental slump.
He's in a mental slump. And that's what you want him to do is go back to fundamentals and make every single play. If he does that, then he can relax a little bit because each time it becomes a little easier. He has the skill set and he got a couple of errors put on him because of his advanced range.
Yeah.
And that was unfair.
That's where fielding percentage is unfair because he got to the ball.
He got to the ball that most people, even if they got to the ball, would just eat it and there's no error, the guy would be given a hit. But because he tried to make the play,
right.
they gave him an error on those plays. So I think Rosario will be fine. It happened in bunches. And what you hate for as a young player for that confidence to go, once that confidence gets lost, that's where it really becomes, you know, you get really worried about him and you see him kind of taking more time off.
Well, I'm glad that to wrap up this pitching in-depth conversation, we went back to defense, actually, because if you look at some of the, yes, you do need to catch the ball. Mm-hmm. Can't strike everyone out. And one metric that you look at in terms of predictive metrics that are pretty reliable in this case of the batting average on balls in play, right. and they're pretty high for guys like DeGrom and Syndergaard, and that says that they're unlucky, but it also says potentially something about their defense. That yes. when the opponents put the ball in play, Mets fielders maybe are not getting errors. Sometimes they're getting errors, but maybe they're not always making the play. Make one more point, and then I'm being yelled at or gently spoken to get us out of here.
Well, that's the other thing is with the advanced metrics and the shifting that the Mets are doing more than ever before, and we've noticed that with guys going on to the
yeah.
other side.
Yeah.
So you're going to see those things happen where those plays are not being made and that high BABIP is because where these guys have the nasty two-strike stuff, teams are just putting that ball in play and getting the slow roller that are giving them hits. It's not the 100-mile-an-hour mm-hmm. ball that gets hit right to a guy that right. isn't being made. It's the slow rollers that they're getting to, or two guys again. We saw with Cano yesterday where he tried to slide and dive and neither guy could get to that ball. Meanwhile, it's a slow roller right. that needs to
be. Well, they've been playing. And one thing about the shift is it's great and based on data, but they've been playing it one way their whole life. So it's like, oh, wait, now there's two of us standing here. I could see yeah, how that would
confusion.
Be an adjustment.
There's confusion that lies in there. And when you don't have enough reps to do it, it's yeah. not spring training anymore.
Right.
So it's like on the fly, okay, this is the formation you're going with, go. And now everybody has to kind of read what happens off of that. So I think those things will iron themselves out. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating for a pitcher when you make a two-strike pitch and there's no shortstop behind you, and it's a weak ground ball that the third baseman is now trying to range over to get. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, is where the BABIP is telling a story that these guys will be better, and they have to execute better, and they'll tell you that with two strikes.
Nelson, normally Doug and I spend the last 3 to 5 minutes of this just I don't know if you listen. It'd be nice if you did. But we talk about what we did on our weekends and we get a little silly with each other. We give each other a hard time. You have provided so much quality, serious baseball analysis, which apparently I normally don't because we have time to screw around. We don't have time for the fun stuff at the end right now because there was so much good content from you. Which, by the way, you're bringing to Baseball Night in New York 5 nights a week. And how much I've been on this show since day one. And this show, in my mind, has never been better simply because of your arrival on it every
Thank
night.
You.
We
I
got you
that.
From the pre- and post-game show. It's this incredible privilege at 6 o'clock to have your analysis every night. So it's if you're not watching BNNY out there, but you listen to this podcast,
time.
Please watch
time.
Nelson on BNNY 5 nights a week. You're going to hear it like that. We used to be sillier on that show, too. But now this guy comes around. He's got so much analysis and information.
I got to hold them together. I'm the glue.
You're the glue of the show. So we can't even goof around as much because Nelson's talking baseball.
But
you got your finger in the air. You want to make one point.
Last point.
Take us out.
You know what I did on Saturday?
Oh, you're going to tell us. Good. Go ahead. What did you do on Saturday? Get something good.
We, the pre- and post-game from last year, mm-hmm. we won our first Emmy.
That's right.
So
congratulations.
I was at the Emmy. Thank you. Thank you. So Gerard Guilfoyle, Michael Flynn, Dave Mandel, Robinson, the producers, Gary Apple, Todd Zeal, Jim Duquette, everybody that's involved with the show, Sean Gelman, yourself included, you know, everybody that's involved with the show. It was our first Emmy. Couldn't be prouder. It was really a nice thing to have happen that day and to see Guilfoyle's face light up when he went up there to receive the award.
Gerard Guilfoyle, a guy who does so much behind the scenes here, with a talent that works on those shows, is special, deserve to be rewarded. What's funny about that for me is that we've got former Major League pitcher in the building. We have Todd Zeal, former Major League All-Star in the building, a former GM of two teams in Jim Duquette. And for some reason, they ask my opinion on things. And on that, I will send you out. Thank you for joining
MLB
us,
Insider.
Nelson. MLB Insider, sure. Okay, whatever that means. You also have people who know what they're talking about. Goodbye, everybody.
Pleasure.